information, and hoped that he'd be able to keep them all straight.
I am.
Andrea sent me. My name is Kazi Fo. Wait, Mikhail said, pressing a finger to her lips. Don't tell me your full name. In fact, don't tell anyone your real name if you can help it. Not on a night like this. Where are they? I left them across the street. I wanted to make sure it was safe. Well done. You told them my name? I told them you are Bloskin, a black hat, bronze rose. I told them you knew their mother. Mikhail squinted at her. Are you a black hat? An iron rose. But I don't have it with me. It's hidden. Good. Don't show that rose to anyone. It's too dangerous. Why didn't you leave the city during the invasion? Kazi glanced back into the street, taking a half step away from Mikhail. He could practically feel her distrust. Black hats were the Lady Chancellor's secret police. They were inherently distrustful, but should always be able to count on each other. The invasion and subsequent occupation had changed all the old rules. You don't have to tell me anything about yourself, Mikhail reassured. I was just curious. We all have our reasons. Yeah, we do, Kazi said, her tone standoffish. Mikhail needed trust right now, people he could depend on. But his list of trusted contacts was pitifully small, so why should hers be any longer? If he wanted to know more about Kazi, he'd have to ask their mutual contact. Get out of here, he said. Get some sleep. There'll be more families tomorrow. He grabbed her sleeve as she turned to go. Cover your head. Your hair stands out in the darkness. Also, careful of the patrols. They're changing up their routes. He waited until Kazi had headed back toward the secret paths up to the landfall plateau, before crossing the street and entering the alley she'd emerged from a few minutes prior. The alley was littered with old crates, barrels and other refuse, and he couldn't immediately pick out anyone hiding there. "I'm Bloskin," he said in a loud whisper. "Kazi has gone home. You're with me now." Slowly, figures emerged from their hiding places. The first was a man, medium height, with long, dark hair under a flat cap. He held a bundle in his arms, which Mikhail quickly realized was a child, no more than a year old. Five more children of various ages followed.
"Kazi said you know my wife," the man whispered urgently.
Part of Mikhail's job as a spy had always been knowing when to tell the truth and when to lie, and when to walk the grey places in between. "I don't, actually. I don't know who you are, except that your wife is a silver rose, and we need to get you out of the city. That'll have to be good enough, unless you want to risk the Dionysus purges." The children huddled around their father, who seemed at a loss. He looked around at the waiting faces before finally nodding at Mikhail.
"We don't have any choice but to trust you. But this is my family. If you so much as..."
"Don't threaten me," Mikhail said with a tired sigh. "It's childish. You can either let me do my job, or I can go find somewhere to sleep. Now, are we getting you out of the city or not?"
"Is Bloskin even your real name?" the father asked.
Mikhail could hear the tension in his voice, and he wished that for once this process could be simple. "No, and I suggest you not tell me yours." Mikhail squinted at his pocket watch, trying to discern the time in the darkness.
"Kazi got you here late, so if we're going to go, we need to do it now. Make a decision."
The father's mouth formed a hard line.
"We'll go."
"Right, follow me, and no one make a peep." Mikhail led the family back the way they'd come, and began to cross streets and duck through alleys in a pattern that might look to an observer to be entirely random. They crisscrossed their own paths several times. but he led them steadily north through the suburbs until the streets began to widen and the tenements and stores began to thin. They were soon among small two-story houses, ducking through one of the many palo quarters of the city, where the streets weren't cobbled, the gutters were filled with trash, and the Dionysus patrols were fewer. For 8 nights, Mikkel had done a variation of the same route, carefully planned out during the day, and managed not to cross paths with a single Dionysus patrol. On this night, however, the patrols were constant, and the group was forced to hide almost every hour. They waited for the third of the patrols to pass by, crouching beneath one of the stilted houses on the floodplains north of the city. Over 100 strong, and led by a soldier whose breastplate was lacquered black, the patrol carried torches, which they thrust into the alleys and under the houses as they went, and Mikkel quietly urged the children to move farther into the darkness. "They've changed the routes," Mikkel whispered to the father. He swore to himself and listened to the ticking of his watch in his breast pocket, knowing time was running short.
"Oh, what does that mean?"
"I don't know. Could be they're getting wise to people leaving the city. Could be that they just change their routine every week or so. Either way, it's going to be more and more dangerous to leave the city from here on out."
"Are we going to be able to get out?" There was a tinge of desperation to the father's voice. Mikkel hesitated. If he was smart, he'd leave the 7 of them here to try and make it on their own. He'd flush his safe house in Upper Landfall, cut off his contacts with Hendress, Kazi, and anyone else, and find the deepest hole in Greenfire depths to wait out this occupation. He didn't need to help these people. His own mother was safely out of the city, and as a spy, he'd never been close to anyone else. But despite his alternate loyalties, he didn't believe anyone deserved to be snatched up by foreign occupiers, least of all, children.
"You'll get out," Mikkel finally said, "but we have to move fast."
The patrol passed, and Mikkel led the family out from beneath the stilted houses. He picked up the smallest of the children, cradling her face against his neck, then began to hurry them all along at a quicker pace. They crossed the sandiest, deepest part of the floodplains and entered the fens. The wetlands were bisected by hundreds of drainage ditches built by convicts in the labour camps. The ditches made poor highways, but it kept them out of sight of the road as they moved farther and farther away from the city. Wet, muddy, and stinking, the group emerged on the opposite side of the fens and crossed the final highway before the coastal plains became cotton and tobacco fields for as far as the eye could see. As in the city, patrol frequency out here had increased, and it wasn't until Mikkel and his charges were hiding in a farmer's shed on the northern side of the highway that he allowed himself to breathe a sigh of relief. Outside, the sky was beginning to lighten. It would be daybreak soon, and that would complicate his return to the city. He glanced at the small faces huddled in the shed, and then at the father, whose eyes were tired and his expression bleak.
"How much farther?" the father asked.
"Until what?" Mikkel responded. "Safety. Long time until then."
He heard the bitter note in his voice and silently scolded himself. He was here to help, not to deepen the man's fears.
"Sorry," he said in a gentler voice. "This is as far as I take you. I've got to get back before it's light. You'll head about 2 miles due north. There's a farmhouse with distinct yellow paint on the east wall. They'll hide you for a day, and tomorrow night get you to a carriage that will take you along the back roads and safely out of range of the Dionysus patrols."
There was a long silence, and Mikkel could see the man steeling himself to try and herd 6 children across 2 miles of open land before the sun came up. Mikkel didn't envy him the task.
"How can I thank you?" the father asked.
The question surprised Mikkel. Most of the smuggled families were so exhausted by the trek that goodbye was a simple nod and then disappearance into the dark.
Just, if you find your wife or reach the armies, or the Lady Chancellor or anyone, you can tell them that people are still fighting in Landfall, and we'd rather not be abandoned.
Come with us, the father said. If an escape route can take 7, it can surely take 8.
The offer was tempting, but Mikkel had made his decision. He was going to stay on in Landfall through this thing, for good or ill. There were more people to keep out of Dainai's hands. He slapped the father on the shoulder. Get moving. If daylight hits you, find a ditch to hide in. Watch the horizon for patrols. Remember that the farmhouse you're looking for has a yellow wall.
The father nodded, and Mikkel opened the shed door and watched the silent, frightened children file out and follow their father into the cotton fields. Mikkel watched them merge into the night, then turned back toward Landfall. From here, the massive Landfall plateau and the city that covered its face and skirted its knees seemed almost peaceful. There was no sign of the bombardment that had scarred the eastern face of the plateau, or the rancid smoke of the fires to the south where bodies were still being dumped. The only sign of battle was a trickle of smoke rising from green fire depths, where the fires were still not out from the Palo riots. Mikkel almost turned and ran to catch up with the father and his children. Better to escape now while escape was still an option, a small voice told him.
Stop being a coward, he told it.
Taking his last swallow of whiskey, he crossed the highway and headed back into the fens to make his way toward the city.
Chapter 6 Mikkel jerked awake, reaching for the pistol on the bedside table, knocking an empty wine bottle and his pocket watch to the floor with a clatter that made his head hurt. He fumbled for a grip and sat up in bed, pointing the pistol toward the doorway, his head hammering in his chest and his eyes crossed badly.
"It's me,"
a voice said gently. Mikkel took several deep breaths and lowered the pistol.
"Sorry," he said. "Nerves a little frayed."
Hendriz stepped inside the tiny room that she and Mikkel shared in a tenement on the south side of the gorge in Upper Landfall. Hendriz was young, or at least what Mikkel thought of as young, though in her mid-twenties she was probably just as old as he. She had brown hair, cut short, beneath a bowler cap, and wore a reddish-brown day labourer's suit, much the same as Mikkel's. Her face had old pock marks down the left side. She had intelligent eyes and a military bearing about her, and had somehow managed to make the rank of Silver Rose in the secret police, despite her young age. Mikkel knew how hard that was from experience. Hendriz closed the door behind her and touched the empty wine bottle with her toe.
"I have no idea how you keep finding something to drink. The Dainais have put the squeeze on everything going in and out of the city, and the booze seems to have disappeared first."
I know a lot of bartenders," Mikkel responded. "Most of them owe me a favour or two."
He squinted at the pistol in his hand. The pan wasn't even primed. He sighed and set it on the bedside table.
"You're a bit shaky with the pistol," Hendriz observed. "Guns aren't really my thing," he said, trying to rub the sleep from his eyes and the headache from his brain.
He looked at his empty flask, sitting on the washstand across the room.
"Pitt, you're a terrible spy," he muttered. "You should not be drinking."
"What's that?"
Nothing.
Hendriz moved to sit on the edge of the bed, then suddenly recoiled.
"By Adam, what's that smell?"
"Had to go across the fens last night to get that family out."
"I thought we agreed you were going to wash before coming to bed. You know I have to sleep here too, right?"
"Sorry," Mikkel said, though he didn't feel it. Got Co out near dawn because your courier showed up 40 minutes late, and the bloody Dianais changed their patrol routes.
Hendra's pulled a face and finally sat down beside him. They'd known each other for all of 3 weeks. Hendra's was one of the regiment of Black Hats that had stayed behind to help hold the city after the Grand Master was killed by Stike. She returned with Mikkel to try and make a difference during the Dianai's occupation. They spent the first week hiding, and screwing, in a Black Hat safe house, before the occupying forces finally instilled order on the city. Since then, their relationship had cooled to purely professional, and Mikkel was glad for it. He already liked Hendra's for her competence and her lack of questions. He didn't need to get any more attached.
"Someone threw a bunch of grenades into a crowd of Dianai's soldiers," Hendra said.
"So?"
"That's probably why they changed the routes. It killed 3 of them, injured 20 more."
"Pit!"
Mikkel scratched his head vigorously with both hands, trying to wake up. "Someone could be other Black Hats, or partisan for Trastans, or just Palo trying to stir up chaos. It meant bad things for his and Hendra's efforts."
"What time is it?"
"1:30.
Where have you been all morning?"
Hendra sighed, picking at something on her sleeve.
"Setting up the next family to get out, and trying to find out how many of us are left."
By us, she meant Black Hats.
"Yeah? Any progress?"
Mikkel didn't want to make contact with any more Black Hats. Someone higher up the food chain might know about his betrayal, but he couldn't very well tell Hendra's that.
"Oh, some. There's rumours, but everyone is laying low. As far as I can tell, most of the higher-ranking Roses left the city with Lindit."
"And abandoned their families in the process," Mikkel said, unable to help the note of bitterness in his voice.
He shouldn't blame everyone who abandoned the defence of the city. They were only following orders. But he wasn't inclined to feel kindly toward men and women who'd left their families to the mercy of an enemy army. Hendra's remained silent. They'd had this discussion several times, and she was obviously conflicted regarding her loyalty to the Lady Chancellor. Loyalty was meant to come unquestioning to a Black Hat. This war made things complicated.
Mikkel waved the thought away. "But we're here to take care of those families," he said, throwing back the thin covers and sitting up.
He caught a whiff of himself, and the fens he'd dragged himself through to get home this morning, and almost passed out again. Hendra's dashed to the doorway, covering her nose.
"Go wash, now!" "I will, I will!"
Mikkel searched for his pants.
"You sound like my mother," he muttered.
"I what?" "Nothing."
Mikkel dressed quickly and headed into the hall, ready to go find a public bath. He leaned against the wall, trying not to get dizzy, and wondered where he'd find some breakfast. Food was already becoming a problem, what with the Dianais closing the port, and it would only get worse as the occupation went on. Hendra's joined him, keeping her distance. He opened one eye and caught her staring at him.
"Well?"
She shifted her feet.
"You're being careful, right?"
"At night? Of course."
"You're changing your route out of the city every time?"
He hadn't been.
"I am. I will. Tonight.
Best not to take any risks with the patrol routes changing."
There was a long moment of silence, and Hendra's continued to stare.
"You're being followed."
"Excuse me?"
Hendra's reached into her breast pocket and produced an envelope. It was sealed with wax. "A Palo kid was waiting outside the building this morning. He handed me this and said to give it to you."
"By name?" Mikkel asked, his heart jumping into his throat.
He had been careful, very careful, every time he returned to the safe house. There was no way he was followed.
By name, Hendricks confirmed, watching his face intently.
Mikkel took the envelope and broke the seal. He was fully awake now, like he'd downed 6 cups of iced coffee, and he bit his lip as he read the note. It was just an address followed by a time. 2 o'clock. At the bottom was a single letter, T. Mikkel took a deep breath to calm himself.
"Are we found?" Hendricks asked.
"We're fine," Mikkel responded.
"What time did you say it was?"
"A little past one."
His chest feeling tight, Mikkel headed down the hall. "I gotta go," he called over his shoulder. "If I'm not back in a couple of hours, you should leave the city."
"Do you need backup?"
Hendricks asked, a note of concern in her voice.
"One help."
Mikkel reached the street, looking for a hackney cab, then remembered there were few and far between since the occupation. He shaded his eyes against the hot afternoon sun, pulled his collar up, and went to see Taniel. Mikkel crossed the city on foot. With no functional government to pay the pig keepers or the sweepers, the gutters overflowed with shit and trash. Every third person seemed to be a Dionysian soldier, while the citizens who would not, or could not, flee with Lady Flint's army, went about their days with eyes cast toward the ground, fear writ plain on their faces. The entire city felt subdued. Rubble spilled into the street, and whole blocks had burned down in the fires caused by rioters and shelling. Only a concerted effort by volunteer fire brigades had kept the entire city from going up in smoke, though there were places where the smell of soot was so thick no one dared go out without a handkerchief over their face. Mikkel lowered his eyes and tipped his hat to every passing Dionysian patrol. The strangely armoured soldiers rarely took an interest in one man and moved through the city as a show of force rather than any real policing action. He was able to reach Greenfire Depths without incident, and he rounded the rim of the great old quarry, eyeing the smoke that still rose from the charred remains of the slum. Over half the tenements in the depths had been destroyed by fire. Surviving Palo huddled in the few open spaces at the bottom of the quarry, some even spilling out on the rim. Rumours swirled about desperate Palo looting the homes and businesses of the people who had fled, and Mikkel could not find the energy to be surprised, or to blame them. These were not times, he decided, that he would judge any man for acting in fear. Around the northern rim of the depths, he reached the address indicated in the note. Instead of finding the Hotel Henria, which had stood for over 100 years and was ancient by the standards of the young country, he found only its charred stone foundation. Mikkel passed the blackened stone, confused, and wondered if perhaps he'd read the address wrong. There was barely anything left of the place, and the little passing traffic paid it no mind. No one had any time for a burned relic. He checked the note in his pocket, then glanced at his watch. 2:05, and yes, this was the right address. Perhaps, he decided, the note had been delivered a couple of weeks late. This kind of communication was not always reliable. He hid in the shadows of the ruin while a squad of Dionysian soldiers marched past, their breastplates gleaming in the sun, colourful feathers hanging from their shouldered muskets. Once they'd gone, he decided to have a quick look around before heading back to the safe house. He'd only climbed onto the lowest of the foundation stones when a figure caught his eye. He let a half-smile cross his face and carefully picked his way through the unstable ruin to where the former southern wall of the hotel perched on the very edge of Greenfire Depths. A man sat on the burned-out foundation, the back of an expensive suit pressed carelessly against bricks blackened by smoke and soot. He was tall, worn but handsome, with hawkish features and striking blue-grey eyes. His black hair was hidden beneath a top hat, and one leg dangled carelessly off the 200-foot drop into the quarry. He held a weathered old sketchbook in one hand and a bit of charcoal in the other, and as Mikel approached, he could see a rather good rendition of the depths. The man was fair-skinned, but the hand clutching the charcoal was a bright red, the skin hairless and smooth like a child's.
"I didn't know you still kept a sketchbook," Mikel said.
Taniel Two-Shot, the red-hand terror of the Fatrastan frontier, squinted down into the fire-ravaged slums of the depths and made a few quick marks in his sketchbook before flipping it closed and stowing it in a leather valise. He pulled a glove over his right hand, then picked up a silver-headed cane and pointed it at Mikel.
"You're late," he crinkled his nose, "and you smell."
"Everyone's a critic," Mikel muttered.
"Louder," he said.
"I wasn't expecting to meet in a ruin."
"Ah, right,"
Taniel grimaced.
"I wasn't expecting that either, to be honest. You know, Pol and I stayed here for several months when we first came back to Fatrasta. Third floor, corner suite."
Mikel glanced around, half expecting to find Taniel's silent companion lurking in the ruins of the hotel.
"Where is she?"
"Hiding outside the city. Landfall is crawling with bone eyes. Pol may be able to turn a god inside out with raw power, but she's all self-taught. We don't want to risk the Dainai's finding her until we're ready for a serious fight."
The thought both scared and exhilarated Mikel.
"Well, makes sense. So what brings you back? I thought you two left with Lady Flint."
Taniel stood up, balancing on the foundation stones, hopping from one foot to the other, before glancing down at the long drop and stepping into the safety of the ruin of the hotel. He brushed a bit of soot off his sleeve, a wasted effort because he was covered in it.
"Never left."
Mikel made a noise in the back of his throat and pursed his lips.
"You've been here for 3 weeks. You're joking." "Afraid not. Lindet abandoned the city. The Dainais, despite all their spies, really have no idea what they're getting into. It was too good an opportunity for me to do some poking around."
Mikel paced back and forth, kicking a loose brick into the ruins of what had once been the hotel's wine cellar. The brick clanked twice, then shattered a bottle. 3 weeks of flailing around, helping the Black Hats because those were the only allies he knew, worried one of them would find out who he really was and put a knife in his back. All while his real master was wandering around the very same city. Mikel talked himself down from shouting and simply said,
"You could have told me."
Taniel eyed him. Two-Shot could be warm as a brother or very, very cold. This time he offered a neutral shrug.
"I had no idea where you were. I could have used your help sorting through Black Hat files. It wasn't until yesterday that one of my contacts was able to track you down."
"Right."
Mikel wondered whether to believe him. Master or not, Taniel had his own agenda. It was kept secret for a good reason, but it didn't make it any easier when Mikel was left in the dark.
"So what happens now?"
"I understand you're still with the Black Hat. I've bunked up with the Silver Rose. We spent the last week or so trying to get Black Hat families out the city before the Dainai's agents find and kill them."
"Commendable."
Taniel stared at him for several moments until the silence grew awkward.
"Do the Black Hats know you betrayed them?" he finally asked.
"I don't think so,"
Mikel responded hesitantly.
Hendris, the Silver Rose I'm working with, knows that Fidelis Jess wanted me dead before Stike cut off his head. But I don't think she knows why. The fact that I'm here helping the Black Hats seems to be enough for her. It seems I'm still a gold rose. The silence returned, punctuated only by the sound of Taniel tapping his cane against a brick. After half a minute, he seemed to come to some sort of decision.
"Are you still my man?" he asked.
Mikel opened his mouth, but found himself unable to respond. He worked his lips for several moments, fighting back the urge to punch Taniel in the mouth. "I spent 6 years dirtying me hands for the Black Hats on your orders." His voice rose in pitch. "I betrayed the most dangerous man in the country for the Red Hand. I—"
"Ah," Taniel said gently, "I'm not trying to offend you honestly. I needed to ask. The world is volatile right now."
"I'm still your man," Mikel answered sharply, "and I'll ask you kindly not to question that again." The fact that Taniel even felt the need to ask smarted, but he tried to remember that this was a game much bigger than either of them. Infiltrating the Black Hats had been the greatest accomplishment and danger of Mikel's life. Now, with the Dionys in play, well... Taniel was right. Everything had changed. "I won't. I need you to remain in the city."
Mikel had planned on staying in the city to help the Black Hats, but the request still surprised him.
"For what?"
Taniel pursed his lips thoughtfully, staring off into the distance for a few moments. "I need you to do something dangerous."
"You'll have to be more specific." "There's a woman. Carp Pole and I have been in contact with her off and on through the last few years, and she's fed us information regarding the Dionys."
Mikel turned his head.
"What do you mean by that?"
"No one knows anything about the Dionys, not before they arrived on our shores. Any information you can dig up in Fatrasta is from before they closed their borders. At least 100 years old. How could you—"
The dots connected in his head, and he found his mouth hanging open.
"You had a spy in Dionys."
Taniel idly tapped his cane against a blackened foundation stone.
"We did. Only Carpole and I know, and I'd like to stay that way."
"Cresemir on a stick, Taniel. If you had a spy in Dionys, how the pit didn't you know that there was an invasion coming?"
"We suspected the invasion."
"And didn't tell me?"
"Couldn't risk distracting you."
First Taniel questioned his loyalty, and now this. "You didn't answer my question."
"She's not..."
Taniel sighed. "She's fed us information, but she's not a spy, and not in the same way you are. She's still a loyal Dionys. She didn't tell us when exactly the invasion would happen, because she hasn't been in contact for over a year. But over the last few weeks, she's gotten back in touch with us."
"And?"
Taniel held up two fingers. "A couple things. One, she knows an immense amount about the Dionys hierarchy. She knows some of their plans, and most of their strengths and weaknesses, which makes her wildly valuable. Two, we think she's in danger. I need you to find her, convince her to leave, and extract her from the city."
Mikel ran his hands through his hair.
Excuse me.
"Find and extract her."
"Yes, I heard the first and third things you said. I'd like you to repeat the second."
"I told you. She's still a loyal Dionys."
"So," Mikhail said, drawing the word out. You want me to extract a spy who isn't a spy, who probably doesn't want to come with me.
Well, that's about the size of it.
Why don't you do it? You're still here.
Taniel snorted in frustration. Despite our best efforts, we haven't been able to find her. And we have to leave.
Mikhail resisted the urge to ask where Taniel and Karpol were heading next. Taniel wouldn't tell him anyway. Compartmentalization, after all.
And the black hats?
If they're useful, use them, Taniel said with a shrug. But I have the feeling you'll be in over your head. Anyone from Fidelis Jess's inner circle might know more about your betrayal and try to kill you.
I thought all the gold roses left Landfall with Lindit.
At least one remained behind, but I don't know which.
A shiver went down Mikhail's spine. Every rumour had pointed to the fact that the high-ranking roses had left with Lindit. He was still using Black Hat resources, safe houses, caches, message drops. After the first week, he decided that no one left in the city knew his true role in betraying Fidelis Jess, and he'd not been cautious enough with those resources.
Pit, he breathed.
He took a moment to walk around the ruin, trying to shake loose his own sense of dread. Extracting an informant could be tricky at the best of times, but finding a foreigner in an occupied city could be next to impossible. Especially if she didn't want to be found.
He summoned an inner calm, trying to come at the problem logically. If he was cautious, he could continue to use Black Hat resources. He could moonlight with Hendris and spend his days tracking down his Dainai's informant. Once he found her, he'd have to deal with convincing her to leave. Getting her out of the city, as long as his escape routes were still open, would be the easy part.
Right, he said, returning to Taniel. I'll do it. What help can you give me? And what can you tell me about this woman?
Taniel produced an envelope and handed it over.
These are the addresses of my personal safe houses. Memorize them and burn the paper. You'll find money, gold, weapons, food, and a safe place to sleep. Some of them may have been destroyed or compromised during the riots, I don't know which ones. There are also a handful of names in there, loyal agents of mine who've remained behind. I suggest using them, sparingly, and only in an emergency.
Well, this'll help, Mikhail said, taking the envelope. And the woman?
Her name is Mara. I don't know what she looks like, beyond the fact that she's Dainai's. She's embedded with a Dainai's higher-ups, so reaching her might be difficult.
In what way?
She's attached to the retinue of one of their ministries. I don't know which one.
Anything else?
Taniel clearly hesitated.
That's all I know that can help you. You're certain?
Yes.
Mikhail knew Taniel well enough to know when he was holding something back, and that he wouldn't spill the beans if he didn't want to.
Right. I'll see what I can do.
Taniel stood up, adjusting his gloves and cuffs and straightening his jacket.
Be cautious, my friend. If the Black Hats find out what you are, they'll torture and kill you. The Dainai's will do worse.
Mikhail scoffed outwardly, while his stomach twisted in a knot.
What could possibly be worse than torture and death?
Taniel offered a hand, and Mikhail shook it. Without another word, Taniel picked his way through the ruins of the hotel and disappeared into the street. The warning echoed in Mikhail's head, raising goosebumps on his arms. How the pit was he supposed to find this woman, let alone convince her to leave Dionysus? He might have to resort to a kidnapping, which posed its own set of problems. This was going to get him killed, and he knew it. Taniel probably knew it too.
Mikkel took his time returning to the safe house. He stopped by one of the few remaining coffee houses in the city and traded a few coins for a pitifully small amount of coffee that didn't even have ice. He drank it slowly, considering, trying to come up with a plan to accomplish this impossible task Taniel had just asked of him. He would have to widen his operation, recruiting other black hats and old contacts, perhaps even risk contacting the remaining gold roses that Taniel had warned him about. That would be a last resort, of course, but the option was there. Mikkel finished his coffee. He would have just enough time to reach the safe house before curfew. He'd get a couple of hours of rest, and then there'd be another night of smuggling families out of the city. He could meditate on the problem during the mission. A short time later, he walked down the street toward the safe house, tipping his hat to a passing Dionysus soldier, who told him, in broken Adran, that the curfew was 15 minutes away. As he rounded the last corner, he felt his feet slowing involuntarily, his senses responding to the long instinct of a spy, rather than any particular stimuli. He came to a stop, eyeballing the street, looking for something out of place, and then stepped onto a nearby stoop to continue his examination. It took him several seconds to see what his instincts had responded to. Three Dionysus soldiers loitered near the entrance of the tenement containing the safe house. Mikkel focused on them for a moment, trying to decide if their presence was a coincidence, when a movement caught the corner of his eye. Another Dionysus soldier peeked over the rooftop of the tenement, his face barely visible beneath the Morian helm. Mikkel felt his pulse quicken, and now that he knew what to look for, he quickly spotted the extra soldier at the opposite intersection, and then another lurking in the window of the apartment 2 doors down from his safe house. Mikkel's mouth went dry, his legs twitching with a desire to run. The safe house was compromised. Hendriss was either dead, captured, or had gone underground. Mikkel ran through a checklist of items he'd left in the safe house to make sure there was nothing he couldn't abandon, then cursed himself for a fool. He should have realized earlier. If Taniel could find him, so could the Dionysus.
Chapter 7 Vlora stood on the dark slopes of the Hadshaw River Valley with a half-empty skin of watered wine dangling from one hand. She hugged herself, Olam's jacket thrown over her shoulders, and stared into the darkness. The garment, smelling of Olam's sweat, cologne, and favourite tobacco, had a comforting effect that allowed her to think about the last few weeks without becoming overwhelmed. 2 days had passed since what the soldiers had taken to calling the Battle of Windy River. 2 days since the second Dionysus army had been spotted, and 2 days since a Fatrastan colonel had served her with a warrant of arrest from Lady Chancellor Lindit. It was a stupid gesture, of course. Both Vlora and Lindit knew she wasn't going to accept the warrant and come along quietly. The colonel had given her the papers and returned to his own army, and Vlora suspected that the paper was simple ceremony, something to tell the Fatrastan soldiers that the mercenary defender of Landfall had done something to lose Lindet's favour. Vlora sipped her wine. She'd not slept well for almost a month. Her eyes were tired, her body sagging. She refused to take powder until she actually needed it, forcing her body to accept the fatigue rather than give in to addiction. The last thing she wanted was powder blindness. "Are you all right?" a voice asked through the darkness. Flora felt Olam's hand slip into hers and gave it a little squeeze. He came to stand beside her, wearing the same blood-soaked shirt he'd had on since the battle, an unlit, half-smoked cigarette hanging from his lip. He wore a bandage around his left forearm to protect the stitches of a deep cut he'd received from a Dionysus bayonet.
"Not really," she answered.
Olam stared off into the night for a few moments.
"Normally, people just lie and say yes when they're asked that question."
Flora took a half step closer to him and put her head on his shoulder.
"They're burying another 43 soldiers."
She let her gaze fall to a small gathering of torches about 100 yards down the side of the valley, where her men threw the last few shovels of dirt on the graves of soldiers who'd given in to their wounds during the course of the day.
"Still bothers you, does it?"
Olam asked. She looked up at him, barely able to see his bearded profile in the darkness.
"Doesn't bother you?"
"I..."
He was silent for a few moments.
"One of the women they just put in the ground has played cards with me for 12 years. I'm gonna miss her. But I'm a soldier, and I can't stop and think about all the death, or I won't be able to function tomorrow."
Flora shivered, though the air still retained much of the damp heat of the day.
"I've built up plenty of calluses toward death. But some days..."
She lifted her eyes past the burial, over the fires of the Riflejack camp, and across the river to a sea of flickering lights that spread out in the distance on the other side of the river. The Fortrastan 2nd Field Army had arrived yesterday. It was enormous. Over 50,000 men, plus auxiliaries and camp support. And as much as Flora would like to have taken comfort in their presence, she was all too aware of that warrant of arrest sitting on the table in her tent. Olam searched his pockets, giving up after a few moments. He seemed to sense the direction of her gaze.
"I'm not entirely pleased," he said, "that they decided to camp there."
"I don't think we're meant to be pleased." For the first time since coming to this damn country, Flora felt small. Her brigade of mercenaries, just over 4,000 left after this last battle, and most of those wounded, was barely a footnote in the 80,000 or more soldiers assembled within shouting distance here on the banks of the Hadshaw. If she walked up to the ridge, she could see the Dionysus camp to the south, watching her and the Fortrastan army with a caution that their brethren had lacked. She felt as if they were a hammer poised above her, and the Fortrastans were the anvil.
"I gave the order releasing the landfall garrison and the Black Hat volunteers over to the Fortrastans."
"I heard. Are you sure that's wise?"
"If we get sandwiched between these two armies, as I suspect we will, 5,000 or 6,000 men won't make a difference. Besides, they're Fortrastan. Having them tell the tale of the Battle of Landfall might gain us some goodwill."
"We must have made a good impression, because about 1,000 of them have asked to sign on."
"Even knowing about the arrest warrant?" Flora asked.
She raised her eyebrows in surprise. Soldiers could be loyal to the death, or they could blow away with the next foul breeze. She expected anyone willing to join a mercenary company to be the latter.
"The mostly Adran expatriates asking to join. Even here, so far away, Adran patriotism has run high since the Adrankas war."
"I'll take it, I suppose,"
Flora said reluctantly.
"Sign them up and spread them out among the companies. We'll need to fill out our numbers if we get out of this situation."
"And if we don't get out?"
"Then they'll learn firsthand about the risks of being a soldier of fortune."
"I see the calluses are growing back already."
Flora gave a tight smile, though he probably couldn't see it in the dark.
"Have our scouts reported anything from either camp?"
Nothing of particular note. The Dainais are probing both sides of the river with quite a lot of caution. So far, they haven't made any move to set up on our flanks. Seems that the Mad Lancer desecrated a few hundred of those Dainais cuirassiers and left the bodies where they'd be found. I have no idea what the Dainais are used to, but that probably turned a few stomachs.
Including mine. One of these days I'm going to have to rein Stike in, and I'm not looking forward to it.
Neither am I.
Olam turned his head toward her.
Is that my jacket?
Yes.
He reached into the breast pocket. A match flared to life a moment later, lighting his cigarette and illuminating a pleased smile.
There's some communication between us and the Fatrastans, but mostly trade. Our boys are making good use of their camp followers while they have them.
And spending all the money Lindet paid us to defend Landfall. Soldiers have no sense of planning for the future, do they?
If they did, there wouldn't be soldiers. I say let them enjoy themselves while they can. We might be fighting those for Trastan soon.
Flora's stomach clenched, and she instinctively glanced south toward the Dainai's camp. Hammer and Anvil. The arrival of the Fatrastans had only delayed the inevitable. How much more time did she have to plan until the enemy decided to strike? How long could this standoff last? Hours? Days? Weeks? And when it finally happened, which army would turn on her first?
"We could turn them against each other," she murmured.
"Eh?"
"The Dainais and Fatrastans. If they didn't both want my head, they'd focus entirely on each other. They'd barely even notice us."
"We could fake your death," Olam suggested.
"I've never been good at such crass deception," Flora said with a grimace. "Besides, it's too obvious. We need something more subtle."
"Distract them and slip away?"
Flora caught sight of a figure walking up the slope toward them, and she thought she recognized the shadowy form.
"Perhaps," she said slowly.
The figure stopped some 20 yards away.
"General! Colonel!"
a voice called.
"Up here,"
Flora responded. Olam squinted into the night.
"Is that Gusta? I haven't seen him since the battle."
Flora waited to answer until Gusta had reached them, snapping off a shadowy salute.
"Ma'am, sir, Major Gusta reporting in."
Gusta, Flora explained to Olam, was one of just a handful of officers who wasn't wounded the other day.
"Pure luck, ma'am,"
Gusta interjected. She continued. "Right after the battle, I sent him and a squad of dragoons as far north as they could go in 24 hours. I'm glad you made it back in one piece, Major. What can you tell us of the road to the north?"
Gustav removed his hat, dragging a sleeve across his brow.
"The short version or the long version?"
"The short for now."
"Very good. I can tell you that the 2nd Field Army came down the Hadshaw from the Iron Hook Mountains via keel boats. They stripped everything on their way. Supplies, conscripts, local militias. From what we could discover, every town for 100 miles in that direction pooled everything they had into the 2nd Army."
"Leaving them defenseless," Olam said flatly.
"Yes, sir."
"If only I were the pillaging type," Flora murmured. "Go on."
"Supposedly there are 2 more armies on their way down from Thorn Point and Brannan Bay, but with the seas compromised, they could take weeks to arrive. No one knows anything about the armies recalled from the frontier to the northwest."
"They'll come down the Tristan River," Flora said. "I'm not worried about them. Just what's north of us."
"Oh, that's it," Gustav said. "If we head northeast, we're not going to run into anything. There's no word of the Dynai's landing this far north, and everything Lindet has between us and New Arapest is contained in that army across the river.
Excellent, Vlora said. You and your men help yourself to a double ration and hit your bunks. You deserve to sleep in tomorrow.
Thank you, Mom.
Another salute, and the Major headed back down the hill. Vlora waited until he was out of earshot and said, Gustav fought in 2 battles and didn't blink an eye when I ordered him to ride for 48 hours straight. The man deserves a promotion.
Agreed, Olam said.
The tip of his cigarette flared.
Were you gonna tell me about this, scouting mission?
I... Vlora wasn't entirely sure why she hadn't told Olam. It didn't seem important at the time, and we'd been more than a little busy the last 2 days. I sent Gustav on a whim. I didn't expect the path from here to New Adapest to actually be clear.
Sure. Are we going to try and slip away, then beeline it to the coast and head for home?
It's not elegant, Vlora admitted. But yes, that's my backup plan. It may be our best bet of getting out of Fatrastra alive.
If we can give 2 major armies the slip.
Exactly. Vlora scowled at the sea of campfires across the river. Did you ever tell me who's in command over there?
A woman named Zena Holm.
Never heard of her.
She's a stylish noblewoman. Fought in the Fatrastan War for Independence as a soldier of fortune, and has been commanding armies against the Pelor since.
Competent?
As far as I know. Though I think this is the biggest army she's ever commanded.
Vlora considered this for several quiet minutes, working through the various plans in her head, and trying to create something coherent enough to actually work. Get me a meeting with her. Also with the Dynai's general, whoever the pit that is.
When?
Tomorrow. No. Wait. Tonight. As soon as possible. Tell them it's urgent and we'll meet at a neutral location.
She could practically hear Olam grimace. I'll try, but make it happen.
She tugged on the shoulders of his jacket, feeling a real chill for the first time tonight. I'm going to try to sleep for a couple of hours. Wake me up as soon as you've set up those meetings. 3 hours later, Vlora rode north along the Hadshaw River Highway with Olam and a dozen hand-picked bodyguards. She half listened to a corporal droning on about supplies and yesterday's casualties, sniffing a few granules of powder at a time just to stay awake. Across the river, most of the Fatrastan fires were out, and the night was all but silent. Occasionally, her sorcery-enhanced senses spotted sentries along either ridge of the river valley, Fatrastan on the west side and hers on the east. They reached a crossroads and a small keelboat landing, where a party of equal size awaited them on the dusty shore. Torches flickered in the light breeze, casting shadows on sunflower-yellow uniforms.
"Did you hear back from the Dionys?" Vlora asked quietly as they dismounted.
She kept her eyes on a 40-something-year-old woman in the centre of the waiting group, uniform decked out with medals and the black epaulets of a Fatrastan general.
"I did," Olam responded. "The Dionys general refuses to see you. He's convinced it's a trap, and that you hope to get him alone for an assassination."
"He's smarter than his colleague we met a couple of days ago," Vlora said. "Which is unfortunate. I need to size him up. For now, I'll have to satisfy myself with home." She handed her reins to one of her bodyguards and crossed the distance between her and the Fatrastan without preamble. "General Holm," Vlora held out her hand. "Thank you for meeting me on such short notice."
"General Flint?"
Holm took the offered hand, shaking it firmly. She was a stocky woman, broad at the chest, with hands as big as a grenadier's. She had smile lines at the corners of her mouth and friendly eyes that Vlora was more likely to see in a tavern owner.
"I'm a big admirer. This is an odd time to meet, but I'm a night owl anyway, and I figured you had something important to say.